Just a friendly reminder that the opinions expressed on this show are not worth a Canadian penny, so disregard anything you hear that might get anyone in trouble. And despite some of the great ideas you may hear, don't try them at home. Go to friend's house instead.
It's time to get a gun. That's what I've been thinking. Well, I could afford one. And if I did just a little less drinking, time to put something between me and the sun. Time to get a gun.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 30 of Slam Fire Radio for November 7th, 2013. I'm one of your fantabulous hosts, Trevor the Frelate.
I don't know what's going on.
This is the part where you give your name.
You're on way too much caffeine or something, man. That's, hey. It's warning shot here, and the warrior is, he's MIA, I guess.
He's working.
Imagine that, putting work before a hobby that pays
nothing.
So not cool. Owen, we miss you, man. We'll get you next time, I guess. But in other news, seeing as Owen's not here, we thought we'd get somebody who's actually cool. Dan Bolofsky is going to join us later on for an interview, so stay tuned for that.
Don't tell me what to do.
Okay, I wasn't really talking to you. The listeners, more like, is who I was talking to because they're important to me.
I see. Oh, wait, I know where I stand in the pecking order because you hate the listeners, but whatever.
What comes below loathing?
It's that slime in between snake poop and the ground.
It's nice. Well, Trevor, why don't you go ahead and tell us all what you did with guns?
Sure. I got out with my STI Air 15 with the new Stag 3G barrel on it. And, yeah,
nice.
Very happy. I shot it off the bench with the Leupold scope.
Leupold.
At 100 meters. With cheap bulk Norinco ammo, I was able to pull off a couple of groups at an inch and a half. Yeah,
nice.
I was quite happy.
So that'll work out just fine then.
Yeah, so when I start hand loading for it, I'm not going to like really tailor any special rounds. I'm not going to go...
If you're getting an inch and a half with
exactly.
the Nork, just shoot the Nork. I mean, come on. You don't have to reload that stuff.
Yeah.
Just shoot
I will make some 5.56 loads over the winter because I've got a ton of powder. And, the shelf life on powder is only like a week or something, right? So if you don't use
That's right. And, yeah. No, you really got to use
right
that
away.
Quickly.
And that's how you justify, yeah. No, actually, I got in on a powder order with some guys from the club. We went through Higginson's.
Right.
And I picked up 8 pounds of powder for...
Oh, is this the bulk order that you called me up on and said, hey, Matt, you want to get in on this and get some cheap bulk
I don't
you know,
remember
gun
doing
powder
that,
with the rest
and
of
I'll tell you why.
Yeah, no, that's kind of where
I'll
I'm going
I'll tell you why.
The
order was supposed to be dead in the water. Kingston was heading it up, and it was falling apart quickly, and he tried to dump it on me, and I'm like, no, kill it, it's dead.
That's an NA.
Because actually, it was somebody else who wanted the order, and Chris said, well, I'll check with a couple of guys and see if they want to. You know how this works, right? Everybody wants in on it. Nobody's coming up with the cash up front, blah, blah, blah.
And,
next thing you know, I get a phone call at work from Helmut Bitto. Unbeknownst to me, the information on this powder order was flipped over from Chris to Helmut. Well, you can't give Helmut anything and not expect him to get it done.
It gets done. It doesn't matter what it is. He does it. The guy can defy physics.
That's right. He's on another page in another book that I can't even reach on the shelf. So
I thought you were just going to go with read, but you know, reach on the shelf works too.
So he calls me. He says, "I got bad news for you. The 4 pound keg of tight group is not available. What do you want instead?" I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" Anyway, so I ended up with a substitute for Winchester 231 because that wasn't available. I think it's HP38 or something, but don't quote me on that. It's supposed to be the identical powder, just marketed or branded under another name, but it's the exact same powder as Winchester 231. So I got 4 pounds of that and 4 pounds of H335 shipped and taxed and everything for $220. Yeah,
oh, cool.
I think if I was, like, I looked at the price of my 1 pound kegs of H335, and if I had bought four of them, the sticker price on them, it would have cost me an extra $60 over what I saved on this order. So
Yeah. Well, that's all right then.
Yeah.
Cool.
So other than that, it's that time of year again. I'm starting my brass prep, and I don't think I'll ever.
Oh, we're not going to start this again,
are
we? I
don't think I'll ever be done.
Each week, tell us a new way of how you're going to set up your press.
Well, actually, that being said.
Oh, my goodness.
I ordered the RCBS X die for 223, and it's designed so that your brass will not stretch. So once your brass has been full-length resized and trimmed in another die, I'm not up to speed yet fully on the instructions, but once it's
because who reads instructions?
Well,
Come on now. Those are
I will when I get the dies, but I just watched a quick YouTube video. So anyway, before with the now you've done it, now I'm on the roll. Before you had to single stage my 223 brass in a RCBS small base die. And then after it was full and three-sized, then trim it, chamfer it, deburr it, clean it, and then put it through the progressive press. Well, with this new die, I will be able to progressively reload everything on the press the same as I would a pistol brass, right? Once it goes through this, I'll just put it down into the case feeder. It'll get full and three-sized, but will not stretch. So because it will not stretch, I will not have to trim it, chamfer it, and deburr it. So I'm excited about that because it means that I can progressively reload my rifle brass just like I do my pistol brass. And that's all I have to say about that.
And that's all I have to say about
that. Other than that, it's also the time of year for cleaning guns and oiling barrels.
That's funny. I'm cleaning a gun right now.
With this new house, I'm not really sure what the humidity is going to be like in it. I've got guns in the attic, and I've got guns in one of the second floor bedrooms. And I don't have anything like any humidity absorbent material in my gun safes. I don't know what things are going to be like here. So any gun that I'm not going to shoot on a regular basis, I'm going to clean them and then oil the barrels. Like put a good coating of oil inside the barrel and put some oil on a cloth and put it over the blued steel on the guns that I have that actually have blued steel.
Right, you should get some Cosmoline. And it comes off really easy.
Yeah, I heard that.
And
it's also great on toast. So. Yeah.
Definitely tasty on toast.
And other than that, I'm getting ready for a hunting trip this weekend with my dad. You were supposed to come, but you hate me and you suck, so you're not coming. So actually, I was supposed to go deer hunting.
You were going to come.
Well,
see
actually, I was going to go deer hunting, and then that fell through. And then I tried to mooch hunt off another guy, and that fell through. So then,
I was the third choice.
Yeah.
And then fourth choice was, well, screw that. You come here. And
oh,
then
man,
it was like,
that means,
not even
that means
now.
My father is like the last in a long list of people I don't like.
Well, I hope he doesn't listen.
No, he couldn't listen anyway. He'd have to, like, I don't know. We could maybe plug right into his hearing aid, I guess. But anyhow, so me and my dad, we're going to go do some grouse hunting and rabbit hunting on Saturday.
Very nice.
Gonna go to, I don't know any of the places around the new area I'm in to hunt, so I'm just going to not waste time trying to find new spots because the season is, like, we're in the last stretch here of the season. Luckily, we've got Sunday hunting open up now, and it's a long weekend, so I'm going to hunt Friday afternoon and then all Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Got the 870 packed up and my 597, so I might play a little bit with both of those in the woods.
We got till December 7th for grouse.
Oh,
man.
I was just thinking the end of deer season, right?
Yeah, deer. Well, you don't even have deer season in your area.
No, I don't.
It's November 10th here, and then 23rd down south of us.
Maybe Dave will throw us a bone, New Brunswick Random Dave.
Well, that's what we should do. We should get New Brunswick Random Dave to go scout about a little bit, see if he can rustle up some nice bucks, and then call us up, and we'll all head down that way and set up in a couple tree stands or go stalking through the woods or something and see if we can't get us some venison.
Yep. And so,
Dan, I'm putting it out there, man. It's all on to
Dave
you.
Dave doesn't listen, but start listening, Dave, and go get some apples and some carrots. Find a tree.
Yep. And in 3 years, when you finally hear this episode, you'll be like, that would have been a great idea.
No, that'd be cool, though, if Dave could get us out there. I got a couple of tree stands and a ground blind. And I would just really like to take one with, it's a 50-50. I would actually go down there with my crossbow and my 30-30. And then I would decide based on the stand setup what I was going to use.
Yep.
So, so that's
cool.
It for me. How about you, pal? What did you do?
I went hunting.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this hunting or was this walking with a gun?
No, this was hunting. And it wasn't with Matt, so
you
guess
shot
what?
Stuff.
Oh, man. Yeah. So Andre, he's kind of a new buddy. He works out in the oil patch out west, and he's kind of gone for 3 weeks and home for
Is
one
the guy
kind
with
of thing.
The Chris?
Well,
or they're both
Chris? No. You asked me that like a while ago, and it still isn't that guy.
He'll get a Chris.
One day he'll get one. But he did buy an AR based on my recommendation, so
nice.
That's kind of cool. He actually got the same rifle that we gave away for the Nationals.
Oh, excellent.
Yep, so that was kind of cool. Anyhow, so he calls me up or sends me a text, actually, like 6:30 in the morning, so that was cool. I'm kidding. It was fine. It was on vibrate. But he calls me up and says, hey, you want to go hunting tomorrow? And so, of course, I say, yeah, absolutely. So I meet over at his place, and we drive about a half hour kind of out of town and down this dirt road that I've never been on before. And so that was kind of cool. So we're driving along, and we managed to see six grouse altogether, and we managed to get three
Fantastic.
Of them. The first one was, it ran off, it was on the road, and he saw it. I didn't actually see it, so it was on the road, and so we took off into the woods after it, but we didn't catch up to it at all. The second one, he spotted, and I was in a better position to shoot at it, so I was just coming up, and it flew, and I shot, and he said he saw feathers come off it, so we went after it, but it apparently was not wounded at all because I just about stepped on it and it took off again at full flight, scaring the crap out of me in the meantime.
Crazy.
And did not get a second shot on him, so he got away. The third one, we just kind of spooked, and the way the land was set up, I just kind of had this feeling that there was probably another one right there beside it that hadn't flown. I'm like, hold on, go to your left a little bit. There's a couple of trees there. You can see through them into the woods better. I'm going to sneak up to where that grouse flew, and I bet you a second one's going to go, and you tag him out of the air when he flies. He's like, okay. So he heads over there, and I take a couple of steps. Sure enough, another one comes out. It just about exploded in feathers. It was flying full tilt, and then next thing you know, it was head first into the ground. It did not twitch. He just nailed it. So that was really cool. So we cleaned that one up. We went after the other one that we had flushed, but we didn't see it. And then on the way out of the woods, he kind of looking down the road, and he goes, oh, there's a crow in a tree. I'm like, crow? I'll shoot a crow. That's fun. They're on the varmint list. And we look, oh, that's a funny looking crow. oh, that's a grouse. So
you let it pass.
It was a nah. Nah, it's a nay, nay. So it was sitting up there, and it turned out it was a lot further than I thought. It looked like about 30 yards when I shot, but it turned out it was closer to 50, maybe 55, and I had a modified choke in my shotgun. It turned out there were two of them in the tree. So he saw one, I saw one. We identified which ones we were going to shoot at, and we counted to three, and we both fired, and both grouse just kind of hopped to another branch and kind of looked at us and went, what was that? So I was like, okay, well, that sucks. So, second shot, and the grouse that I was shooting at took off down the road. He flew out of the tree, went down the road, and kind of angled off to the left into the woods. And the other one just kind of took off to the right out of our field of view. So we thought he was gone, too. So I'm like, crap, come on. How could I have missed that thing? It wasn't that far. So we walk up to it. I'm like, oh, no, that was a lot further than I thought, I guess. And I look up the tree, and there's that second grouse just sitting there waiting for us to shoot it. So shotgun comes up, takes him out of the tree. So I oblige, no problem. And then I just, as it was falling, Andre took off after the first one that we had seen. And I said, it's just up there to the left. Just run up there and grab it. See if we can spook it again, get it to flush, and we'll shoot it. And so we get up there, and we hear it take off. It was only about four or five wing flaps, so I'm like, it went up into a tree, because only a couple of wing flaps means it didn't go very far. It probably just went back up into a tree. So we start going through the woods real quiet. We're listening, we're looking, we hear one more kind of a flap, and we're like, looking all over, nothing, can't see a thing. There's just nothing around. So all right, well, I guess that one got away. And just as we're getting ready to head back out onto the road, I kind of looked down, and there about 5 feet in front of me was the grouse, dead. So it was just kind of in its death throes. So that second shot that I shot at it before it flew, I actually did hit it, and it just didn't kill it right away. So it flew down into the, just left down the road a little ways and then died, and it's just, you know, dumb luck that I just about stepped on it and saw it, because it was close to the end of the day, and you know, of course, they're so camouflaged, they're hard to see anyway. So that was cool. So we managed to get three.
So then you just took them home and froze them, and you'll deal with them later, right?
That's a nene.
Another nene.
No. Another nene. So first of all, before I get to cooking them, cooking one up, it was so cute. We were kind of heading out of the woods. Yeah, cute. Listen to this. We hear this four-wheeler coming down the trail, and I swear, Grandma and Grandpa, they must have been 98 years old. Grandpa had the shotgun and a gun case on the side of the ATV. Grandma had it looked like a Mossberg 185, one of them bolt action 20 gauges, across her lap, toothless grins, driving by, stop, you know, said hi, like, yeah, just out. I'm like, oh, isn't that sweet?
That's awesome.
Out there, you know, 98. Well, I don't know if they're 98, but they looked like they were 98.
Bless
you know?
Their hearts.
Still. Absolutely, yeah, still out there scaring up the birds, so that was cool. So yeah, I come home, I'm like, yeah, this is lunch tomorrow, this is gonna be delicious. I did a turtle burger. I took a cue from you with your turtle burgers anyway, and I weaved my mm-hmm. bacon. I put the breast, I cleaned it up real good, put it on a tin foil on a cookie sheet. And then I draped the bacon over it to kind of keep all the juices in, because they're skinless, right? Whenever you breast them out, all you know, no skin, so all the right, it all kind of evaporates. So I put the bacon on to keep everything in the oven, 45 minutes at about 325. It came out; it was just running with deliciousness, juices and bacon grease, and so good. So I slice it up. I have these visions of this just perfect toasted club. Roast grouse with bacon and melted cheese for my lunch today, and so I'm slicing it up. I got everything just right. I'm still just a little bit too warm to start putting together and putting in the fridge.
I don't like where this is going.
I go into the TV room. Yep. So we're watching TV. I'm like, okay, well, it's probably time to go, you know, finish up making my lunch. So I walk around the corner.
Can I ask one question? Do you have one less cat living with you now?
Well, let's just say that tomorrow it's going to be roast cat club sandwich.
That's...
He was up there just fine. I could not... So I was like, well, he's eating it now. I mean, I'm not going to eat the food because he's had his dirty, grubby cat litter paws all over it. So I put it on the floor and I whistle for the other... Yes, my cat's coming. I whistle. Whistle for the other cats. The three of them come out, and it was like a scene out of National Geographic, you know,
the
lion pride ripping apart the carcass of the zebra. Because I put down the whole breastbone, everything that was left on it, and, you know, one would hold it while the other one grabbed it with its teeth and rip a strip off, and it was kind of funny and disappointing all at the same time.
Yeah, reminds me of the time that Louis ate a whole deer roast.
At least it wasn't just a grouse.
Awful.
I mean, it, you know, too bad it wasn't just a grouse. I mean, that's a whole deer roast.
We had a taste. It was cooked. We had a taste. We went out hunting grouse. Well, we let it cool. We put Louie in the basement and put up a baby gate.
Yeah, that didn't stop him.
The kitchen looked like a scene from, like, CSI. It was, man, I was sizing up his hindquarters.
Chunks everywhere. Oh, yeah. Yep. So, anyway, that's... I got one more in the fridge, and of course Andre has one, so he'll tell me how his turns out, hopefully. But I got one more in the fridge. I got it soaking in salt water and onion powder and garlic powder and stuff, so trying to marinate it a little bit. Take some of the gaminess out, see if Jewel will like it after I cook it up for her. So we'll see how that one goes maybe tomorrow.
Speaking of gaminess, have you ever taken a spruce grouse?
I have, yes, and they are definitely a little stronger than the...
I've only had one so far, and I didn't notice any distinguishing or any... No.
Oh, no? You didn't... Okay. Did you eat it by itself, or did you have a...
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. When I get a grouse, it goes straight from the woods to a frying pan.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's normally how I do it, too. So, yeah. So, I've had ruffed grouse and spruce grouse kind of in the same meal. And one definitely has a bit of a stronger... It's not bad. Like you said, you don't notice it unless you have something to compare it to. But, they are a little bit...
I know
bit,
some guys won't even shoot them.
Yep, I know some guys like that, too. And I just shake my head and say, yeah, that's no problem,
exactly.
man. More for me.
Cool. So how about we jump into upcoming events slash news?
Slash news. That's right. This isn't a normal segment, but this was a kind of a cool story.
I'll get us through the upcoming events, and then maybe you you sent in the news story so you can take it.
Sound good? Sure.
Awesome. Yeah. So t-shirt orders. Come on, guys. What are you waiting for? We need more people to jump on the list, because right now, I'm going to bring it up here real quick, the t-shirt order list, I mean. Two, yeah.
That's close to 10. If you round up.
Yeah, no.
It would be
No, actually one. Zero. One, we got sticks. So I believe there was somebody else who was supposed to get in on this. Right now I got sticks is down for two shirts. One I have here for him already, and then one other one he wants to order. So we need some more people, folks. I know there are more out there, but the only one I have officially on my list is sticks from the Politics and Guns podcast. So
if you have contacted us and think that your name is on the list, it is not. So contact us again.
Because yet again,
we won't even apologize. Just contact us again and we'll put you on the list.
You don't have to apologize for me. I'll apologize for me. It's my fault. charity shoot. We got some big news to talk about with regards to the charity shoot. We are going to have one. Hopefully, as many of the network hosts as possible can be at the shoot, pushing for the Rescue Gun Club. I'm almost guaranteeing it's going to be at the Rescue Gun Club, unless somebody in Ontario steps up, but I'll just shut them down anyway. I'm going to come out and say it. It's going to be at the Rescue Gun Club. And here's why.
So wait, where's it going to be held?
Rescue Gun Club. Oh, you really ought to look into it. It's a fantabulous place.
It really is.
You should never use the word fantabulous during a gun podcast.
It's too late.
It's out there. Oh, guess who's editing this week? I can take it out.
That's right. You are. You could take that out. I'd like to see you try, though.
You know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see our dear friend from Australia, Steve Lee, make another appearance at a Rescue Gun Club charity shoot.
That'd be cool. I wonder if that's going to happen.
I believe it is. Oh.
Well, listeners will have to wait and see.
But as of right now, we can say that tentatively
it might happen, possibly.
We're negotiating our lawyers, talking to his people, and basically he's trying to get his wife's permission to leave the country is what it boils down to.
Well, I think she's going to come with him.
I hope
again,
so, because,
cool.
I mean, Steve's cool, but really, it's all about her.
It's all about Tracy. Yeah.
So, yep, Steve, and he might bring a couple other Aussies with him, so book your calendar, folks. The one thing that we do have confirmed is the date. That is going to be the last weekend of June. Matthew, did we say the 21st of June or the 28th of June?
Well, I don't know. So apparently we don't have the date because I don't remember either.
I think it's going to be the he's going to do like 2 weeks. He's going to try and do a bear hunt again and then coyote hunting with us. And so we'll have to work it around when bear hunting is. And it's either going to be the 21st or the 28th, folks. So stand by. We'll probably know for sure by next week. So start looking at your vacation time and all that good stuff. 21st and 28th of June. So now you got to ask yourself, do I want to go to the charity shoot? Do I want to go to SummerSlam? Do I want to go to the Tommy course? Or do I want to go to the three gun?
And the answer is yes.
Exactly. Well, that takes us into the next thing, the Paratus Academy shooting course. It's going to be 2 days. It's up to Tommy and when he can get his vacation. He'll know in January. It's my understanding he will know in January when he's getting his vacation. We're pushing for the August 1st weekend. And as of right now, there's one person on the list that's tentative, and that's Mrs. Flewelling. And if she's in, we're at six people.
That's cool.
Half.
Was it 12 was the max?
12 is the max.
All right. So there's only six places left, folks.
It's going to be between $200 and $300. Probably going to settle in on the $250 mark. You'll have a day of instruction with Masada Yub instructor Tommy Nelson from the Gun Dudes, and that'll be on defensive handgun shooting. And the following day, we'll have an IPSC mini match featuring the best stages from SummerSlam. So even if you can't make SummerSlam, you will still get to shoot some of the greatest SummerSlam stages that all your friends will be talking about. So
that'll be cool.
And then the three-gun shoot, that'll take place at the end of August.
Yeah. Very good. I like it.
We're busy.
We certainly is. So is that
I
my turn
it
now?
Is. You want to talk about whiskey?
So I guess right. So. My brother-in-law actually sent this in to me, and then I send it to the show because I don't think he listens because he's not that cool, I guess. I'm Aaron, if you're listening, you are that cool. I'm kidding, man. Don't punch me next time I see you.
In the
guy's
throat,
huge.
Aaron. Get him in the throat.
Right in the throat. Anyway, so Canadian Veterans Charity gets a $132,000 boost from Glenfiddich. Scotch maker is donating $2 for every bottle of its 15-year-old single malt sold
one
in Canada.
One of my favorites.
World-renowned whiskey maker. That's just the headline again, so I'm not going to read that again. So it's donating that to the nonprofit organization that helps members of the Canadian Forces returning from conflict zones adjust to civilian life. The donation, announced Wednesday at the Moss Park Armory in Toronto, amounts to $131,616 and is the biggest gift Wounded Warriors Canada has received since CRR sent them the check for $100 2 years ago. Oh, wait, no. Since it was founded in 2006. But you will remember that we did actually have a charity shoot in honor of
the first
Wounded
one.
Warriors Canada. Yep. That's right. So, yeah, anyway, just wanted to pass that on. That's really cool. Any of you out there who are drinking single malt 15-year-old Glenfiddich, well, you're helping out the Canadian Forces veterans come back from over across.
I can
think
of a couple of guys right off the top. Brian Bolivar's a fan. Jeff Reese a fan. 10X is a fan. Ferlate's a fan. But now yep. I definitely got to get a bottle for this weekend.
Well, there you go.
Awesome.
Very cool.
Well, all right. Why don't we jump into our main topic, which is an interview with Dan Bolosky. He's going to bring us up to speed on his latest court case and what's been happening with that. So let's roll with that, and we'll be back after the interview to do some listener feedback and close up the show. All right. Well, this week, folks, we have a very special interview. If you follow any of the recent events on CGN, you'll know him as Cyclone. His name is Dan Bolosky, and Dan has been taking on the CFO, taking on the man, if you will, in Ontario, and we've invited him on the show this week to bring us up to speed and give us a little bit of background on how he got to where he is and the most recent events that have occurred in court with him and the CFO. So, Dan, welcome to your first appearance on Slamfire Radio.
Thanks very kindly for having me.
Oh, trust me, the pleasure is definitely all ours. I'd like to start off by thanking you on behalf of the firearms owners in Canada, because what you're doing is not only going to benefit you, it's going to benefit all of us in the long run, and I think that's something that our listeners need to consider and remember, that you're not only out there fighting for yourself, you're fighting for all of us, in a sense.
You know what I mean? We're really all in this together, and I'll never forget my introduction to the shooting sports. I actually called up the Toronto Sportsmen's Association, and they said, I can't take my license course because you only offer it on Saturdays, and, you know, I'm Jewish. And they said, no problem, sat me down with somebody on a Sunday, and, you know, I just challenged the PAL, and that was the way I got into my licensing. So we're all in this together, and, you know, it's a really, really great community to be part of.
Things sound like they started off accommodating, but why don't you bring us up the why don't you give us the background and tell us how things have kind of stopped being accommodating for you? So how did this whole thing start in a kind of condensed Reader's Digest version for us, if you would?
Well, I guess the key thing to understand, and this is for anyone who's not from Canada also, is that in Canada we can transport our long guns, our rifles, our shotguns, pretty much, without restriction anywhere we want, to the range, to the gunsmith, to a gun show. That's not a problem. However, in Canada, we have something, a level 2 kind of license to obtain handguns, and on top of your license to own a rifle and your license to own a handgun, you need a special permit called an ATT, an authorization to transport, and this special permit allows you the privilege of moving the guns that you own from your house to the range and back. Now, if you want a permit to take your gun which you own and you're duly licensed twice over, and you want to take it to the gunsmith, well, you need another special permit because your range transport permit won't cover that. So that's your ATT. If you get an ATT that lasts for 5 years, we call it an LTATT, a long-term ATT, but that's sort of the basis. You have to apply for an authorization to transport, just like you have to apply for a license. Now, what happens is even though firearms are regulated federally in Canada on a national level, what happens is that one permit to move your handgun out of your house to the range or out of your house to the gunsmith, that's regulated on a provincial level. And, you know, most people know that provinces are like states or whatnot, but that's our basis, that provincially they have discretion over issuing you not your license, but that transport permit.
And Dan, mm-hmm. if I can interrupt for a second, sure. I understand that on top of having to take a test, which we all have to take nationwide to get our firearms license, in New Brunswick, my ATT becomes automatic for my restricted firearms once I join an approved gun range. But I understand that in Ontario, that ATT is not automatic. There's another test required for you to pass in order to receive your ATT to transport the gun that you already got a license for.
So that's a bunch of fractured history. You're right. What happened in Ontario, and I'm just speaking here from Toronto, so in case anyone ever wants to say there are no urban firearm owners, you know, they're full of it. But in Ontario, there was a regime where they pretty much told the firearms officer, look, we'll offer a club-level course. And after someone completes that club-level course, we'll certify them as safe, and there should be no problem with the club just issuing out these permits to these authorizations to transport the handguns back and forth. What happens is you give someone an inch, they take a mile, and that's for the Americans as well. And no centimeter, kilometer here. And what happened was the chief firearms officer said, oh, yeah, that's good. You should have that course. And I'm still going to come in and have this additional discretion on a case-by-case basis to approve or deny people to have this permission to transport the handguns that they're duly licensed for. So Ontario is kind of weird that way. As well, Ontario refuses to issue a transportation permit that covers you off for gunsmiths and the gun range at the same time. You have to get two different kinds of permits to transport your handguns. In Western Canada, and I've seen the certifications out there, you can transport sometimes between multiple provinces. You can transport to gunsmiths, to border crossings, to verifiers who have been duly approved by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and to the gun ranges, all on one single permit that will last for 5 years. Ontario doesn't like that. They give you a very limited one. And yeah, that's pretty much to cover you off to the gun range and back home.
So where in this process did you run into a problem?
So back in September of 2011, it's pretty sequential. It all happened on September's. So September 2011, I submit this form and I say, you know, I want the kind of authorization that lets me take my handguns for which I'm licensed to own. I want to have that kind of permit to go to the gun range and to a gunsmith, and that I don't want to have to keep calling you guys up for that, to keep calling up the chief firearms office in Ontario for that. And they said, they started to meander. At that point, this is the first of many times where they said, we're not going to give you a flat-out refusal. We want more information from you. And this is the key thing. In Canada, we don't have a recognized right to bear arms. What happens is, in Canada, we have the situation where someone says, well, my discretion is, I'm going to say that I need more information from you and more information from you before I grant you this privilege of transporting your own private handguns. So they asked for more information. They didn't flat out refuse. So finally I kept saying, look, guys, this is what I want, yes or no. And finally they said no. And they've done this with a whole bunch of people. You might know John from ESA. There's a court case in the Superior Court of Ontario. They did the exact same thing to him. But...
So to be clear, Dan, to be clear, you were simply asking for an ATT mm-hmm. to your range as well as a gunsmith?
And a verifier.
And a verifier. So, you wanted basically what Alberta and New Brunswick has. I just want one ATT that covers multiple places once a year.
I used verbatim the conditions that are found on an Alberta, on a British Columbia, on a Saskatchewan authorization to transport.
Okay, so you asked what most of the country already has. You didn't ask for anything special. You just asked for them to enforce the Firearms Act the way most of the other provinces do it.
Definitely. And not only that, the thing is, when you use the kind of wording that is found on government documents in Western Canada, no one can come back and say, oh, that wording is not specific enough. Oh, excuse me, you know, with all due respect, that wording's specific enough for everyone in Western Canada, and it's specific enough for the government to issue en masse. So I said, look, if the wording is specific enough for Western Canada, it's specific enough for an Ontario application.
And yet still they denied you.
And they said, no, you know, it's going to lead to puppies being eaten and, you know, blood in the streets.
Right.
So they said no. And the trick is this. You see, you can actually, there's an appeals process inside the legislation we call the Firearms Act. And you can appeal to the lowest provincial court, the Ontario Court of Justice. And you could say, look, I really disagree with what they did, with what the firearms officer did, and we want a hearing. They know. The Chief Firearms Office knows that you cannot take it to a reference hearing, to an appeal, basically, if they don't deny you. So they can draw it out for a long time and say, well, you know, we're thinking of giving it to you. Just supply us with this, supply us with that. Until they give you a flat-out denial, you can't take it to court. And this was one of those things they said, well, you could have appealed this anytime. And the truth is, no, you can't. You go to the courthouse and they say, well, where's your denial? They don't say, where's this wishy-washy refusal? They say, where's your outright denial? So this is just from someone who experienced it.
All right.
And in the Ontario Court of Justice, you know, we went back and forth in front of a judge, and he was a really, really nice guy. He's actually the judge who overheard the, who ruled on the David Chen hearing. And that was a self-defense case, a citizen's arrest case, actually. And what happened was, in the middle of the day, we went through a whole process. In the middle of the day, the judge says, you know, we'll adjourn for lunch. Maybe you and the chief firearms officer can step outside during lunch and negotiate terms on an authorization to transport so we don't have to have a formal ruling. I said, fine. So we went outside and I said, and, you know, the chief firearms officer said, well, you know, jump through hoop A, B, C, and D, and then I'll give it to you. I'll give you the authorization to transport. And I said, well, quite frankly, I'll jump through hoops A and B, but I don't want to jump through hoops C and D. And he said, no, that's not good enough. So I said, look, you know, with all due respect, and always very polite, I said, Your Honor, we can't come to a conclusion. So we go back into court, and this is with the understanding that negotiations broke down and utterly failed. The judge knew at this point, and it's on record in the transcript, that no negotiation happened and there was negotiated terms offered. It just didn't come to any fruition. So at the end, the judge says, you know, meet back in about 2 weeks' time, oddly enough, in mental health court, where he was presiding at that time. And he said, I'll give you my ruling. And what happened was, inside that appearance, 2 weeks later, the judge goes ahead and says a lot of things from the bench. He gives a breakdown of the history of the case, and he starts giving a little bit of recommendations. And tell you the truth, I was sitting there, I didn't know which way he was going to rule, because if there was a, with all due respect to the judge, it was going either way. He sort of seemed to veer one side and then the other. And then he comes down with at least the definitive words, issue Mr. Belofsky his authorization to transport. And still didn't quite understand it, but the chief firearms officer's representative and his Crown attorney, they left pretty quick. And inside that process, the judge said, you know, this is what I would recommend. You consider putting on an authorization to transport. It's an idea. And at the end, you could tell even the Crown attorney, the government attorney, didn't quite know what the judge said, because he starts to ask questions at the very end of the transcript of the judge's, you know, reasons. And he tries to start narrowing what the judge said, but whatever, it sort of peters off. It's like an ellipse, you know, those three dots at the end of a sentence. So long story short, I didn't know what happened, but I knew that when you go to the Firearms Act, it says every hearing will be resolved via court order. So I knew if I get the court order, I know what the judge said. because that's the cleanest synopsis. I don't have to go apply for a transcript and figure out what exactly the judge said where. I know the judge will put his name on a signed court order, and in Canada we have a long-standing legal tradition all the way up to the Supreme Court that a court order that's written trumps everything. And even if there's a mistake in that court order, until that court order is purposely and inside a court of law challenged, and not challenging what the court order says to do, you have to challenge the actual wording in the court order. So until you do that, that court order is 100% valid, goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it's been confirmed multiple times. Anyway, long story short, the court order is three choices tick boxes, and what the judge ticked off was, it said, give the applicant, give Mr. Belofsky, what he seeks. And we all know what I sought. We know I wasn't going out for a negotiated settlement. I wanted pretty much what I said I wanted. I wanted all or nothing. And after negotiations broke down, after everything, the judge at the end of the day signed a court order and said, give him what he wants.
Now, take us back. When was that, Dan?
That happened, so I sent in the application form pretty much November 2011. We showed up in court September 10th, 2012. The court order was signed, I believe, September 21st, 2012.
Okay, so September 21st, 2012, the judge ruled, give him what he asked for.
And that's the signed court order.
Right.
Interesting, I got it notarized and certified and all that. Next day I went back to the courthouse. I said, you know, can I have another copy? They didn't have the file for some reason. I don't know. But it's a good thing I had notarized copies. When it came down to it, the chief firearms officer said, oh, we're aware of the court order. We're aware of the judge's statements from the bench. We want you to jump through hoops A, B, C, and D, and then we'll give you the authorization to transport. And I said, look, guys, you know, we had an adjournment in the middle of the process. You had the chance to offer negotiated settlements then. It broke down. The judge made a final ruling through a final court order. You can't now come ahead and say, well, jump through hoops A, B, C, and D. That was then, and this is now. Now I have the court order, and a court order has finality. But even then, I still said, okay, look, I'll give you some additional information. These ranges are more than happy to have me, whatnot. And the CFO went around to each of the ranges I said, and they pretty much, and I wasn't there. The conversation that transpired in my mind was, do you really want this guy at your ranges? Keep in mind that we certify your range to stay open. Now, I mean, I know certain things because the person who conducted the interviews with the firing ranges, he was the supervisor in charge of certifying firing ranges. So it's not like they sent a different official. They sent the guy who's tasked with certifying and authorizing firearm ranges to stay open. That's documented. So long story short, they pretty much told me pound sand, you know, we want you to jump through the hoops. What happens is in Canada, there's a process called a pre-enquête, and it's pretty much a private citizen attempting to lay charges. And that's really where all this sort of picks up. I finally went ahead and said to a justice of the peace, I said, look, I have a court order. I showed them it. It was duly notarized and certified and whatnot. And I said, you know, in Canada, there's a law about failure to obey a court order. There's also a law about failure to provide a piece of property. And believe you me, an authorization to transport is a thing. It's a piece of property because there's laws about its revocation that refer to it as a thing and a piece of property. So the first justice of the peace, it's a two-stage process. The first justice of the peace said, yeah, look, there's a court order. It's not being followed. Happy hunting. And I said, you know, I feel a little awkward about, you know, proffering charges against a police officer. And they said, no, a court order is a court order. Had to go to a second justice of the peace because it's a two-stage process. And lo and behold, who was at the second justice of the peace but another Crown attorney, another government attorney. And it wasn't that there was just someone who showed up. That government attorney came with a big binder of paper and opposing arguments as to why the chief firearms officer hadn't done anything wrong in not issuing me the authorization to transport my handguns. And, you know, you sort of start to feel, at least this was my perception, that the fix is in, because the chief firearms officer didn't have to hire an attorney. He took an attorney from the government off of the Guns and Gangs Task Force. So in case you wondered why there are all these gangs wandering free, well, you know, they focus sometimes more on the guns than they do on the gangs. And and what happened was they lost in Ontario Court of Justice. I feel pretty confident saying that. The court order says they were ruled against. And then now at the pre-enquête, they go ahead and they say, well, don't look at the court order. The judge said a bunch of things on the bench. And we really have to look at what the judge said on the bench and read that into the court order, which is, you know, literally a one-liner. The court order says give him what he seeks, not give him what you negotiate, not give him whatever I talked about on the bench. It says give him what he seeks. And Justice of the Peace, the second one, deliberated a bit and then came back a few months later. Justice of the Peace said, look, Mr. Belofsky, you know what you have to do here now, don't you? You know that you have to go back to that first judge and figure out what's going on and come to a negotiation, because that's something the judge suggested from the bench. And she said, and therefore I rule that there's no evidence against the chief firearms officer, and that's why I'm not going to press charges. So, you know, the first thing I did was, because I'm really not argumentative, and I went back to the judge. And
the original judge?
The original judge who gave the court order. And I said, look, you know, all this happened. And the judge mailed me a letter on letterhead. It's an official letter. And says, you know, Mr. Belofsky, I'm functus, meaning I cannot reopen what I've already ruled on. So at that point, I started to realize, look, it's complete ridiculousness to refer me back to a judge who's already said his last word on it. So I started to do some research, because I knew something was wrong with what the Justice of the Peace had done. I just wasn't sure legally what was wrong. I knew something was wrong, didn't know how to phrase it, didn't know what law was busted or an error, which kind of error occurred. I knew something went wrong, so I hit the books. And part of my job is I actually write commentary on the Federal Income Tax Act. So came across a court case, and it's called Sharp. It's, I believe, somewhere around the late 90s, where a judge said a whole bunch of stuff from the bench, and this is, goes up to Federal Court of Appeal. And what happened was that judge later came back and signed a court order that said the exact opposite from the bench. And then the Federal Court of Appeal had to figure out, well, what do you do here? You've got what he said and what he signed. And the Federal Court of Appeal said, look, you know, it may be unprecedented or whatnot, but the signed court order is what stands. Verbal talking from the bench, greatest of respect to the judge, you know, that's not a signed court order. That doesn't have the same finality. And a court order, Canadians have the right to bear court orders. I don't know what anyone's going to say about firearms. We have the right to bear court orders. And that decision from the Federal Court of Appeal was cited in other rulings. And they said, yeah, court order is the final version. Whatever is said, definitely if it's verbal, but they said even if the judge had written reasons for his decision, a signed court order trumps written reasons. So in my case, the judge said a bunch of stuff from the bench, greatest of respect to him, and then he signed a court order. A court order, I believe sequentially, the judge in his mind said, you know, I see what's going on, that this thing can go ad infinitum. If I don't do something final, I'm going to sign, give the guy what he seeks, and that's going to be my final court order. I mean, you know, that's my opinion, but at the end of the day, it's also what's written on the court order.
So you went in the first time, they ruled in your favor, judge signed the court order, give him his ATT, they didn't do it, then you tried to have him charged because it was just, you way too long of a time span occurred and you still hadn't received your ATT, it became unreasonable, so in order to force his hand and get him to follow the court order, you tried to have him charged and the judge wouldn't charge him.
Well, one justice of the peace said, yeah, go ahead. And the second justice of the peace said, she's not going to commit it to a trial.
Tried to send you back to the first judge.
Yeah, so at that point, I started doing my homework. And, you know, I wrote a 30-page factum. It's a legal argument. But so, the thing is, to overturn a justice of the peace's decision not to commit something to trial, you have to demonstrate not only that that justice of the peace made a legal error, she's allowed to do that and her ruling will still stand. You have to demonstrate that she made egregious error. It's called jurisdictional error. That the justice of the peace failed to act judiciously. It's an incredibly high standard. However, if you read a lot of stuff, and this happens a lot in Quebec, the courts are pretty comfortable saying, look, when a justice of the peace makes an error, we're going to call them on it and we're going to reverse them. So two rulings out of Quebec came out, and pretty much what it was is said, if the justice of the peace has to assess what the person who's alleging an offense, the justice of the peace has to assess those allegations. In the justice of the peace's ruling, what she said was, I find there is no evidence against the chief firearms officer. Well, you know, a court order is evidence. And when you say there's no evidence at all of wrongdoing, that's been found by the courts in Canada to be jurisdictional error. That's egregious. With all due respect, you know, a justice of the peace is supposed to assess, do you have sufficient evidence to go to trial? Not do you have any evidence? And the justice of the peace didn't mention anything about sufficiency. She said there's nothing. And there's a great court case in Quebec. And a justice of the peace said, I find there's no evidence. Right at that moment, the Superior Court overturned the justice of the peace and said, no, you said the wrong thing. You fought the wrong thing. You said there's no evidence at all. That's judicial error. The other thing that happened was, what kind of judiciary refers you back to a judge who's already functus, who's already out of it? I thought that was jurisdictional error as well. I thought, you know, if you send someone back and it's clearly a dead end, that means the justice of the peace's whole reasoning was premised on something that was judicially wrong.
So with all these obvious errors, then what happened next? Were you able to use this to move things forward?
Well, yeah, the next step is you go to Superior Court and you apply for an exceptional remedy. It's called certiorari. Certiorari is pretty much, it cuts down the lower court's decision. And then you apply for mandamus, which is an order to do something, which is pretty much an order to rehear the charges or to commit to trial. And I applied to that. We're already now talking, well, this all took place inside November 2013. So we had September 2011, I filed for the original authorization. September 2012, I get a court ruling. November 2013, I show up in front of a judge and say, look, we have a really long-standing tradition that until you contest a court order, that court order stands. And the justice of the peace should have known that. The chief firearms officer was rolling the dice, and, you know, in my opinion, this is all in my opinion. Justice of the peace made that error. The chief firearms officer went ahead and said, I'm not going to contest the court order. What I'm going to do is I'm going to wait if and when someone challenges me for not obeying a court order, then we're going to roll out even more government attorneys to back me up and say that, oh, maybe the court order was unclear. They're going to do all these things. But what happens is we have a really, really strong tradition that a court order stands until you challenge it. The court order can't, and it's very, very specific here, you can't challenge a court order at the same time there's an allegation that you're failing to obey the court order. You can't do that in the same hearing. This is a very important point. It's no different than how if I have a pre-1898 45 Colt, it's a restricted firearm, versus if I have a pre-1898 44 Russian Smith & Wesson, you know that there's one little 0.0 decimal place in the caliber difference, but one's not considered a handgun in Canada and one's considered a restricted firearm. So what we have here is a situation that in the same hearing that they're that the chief arms officer is alleged not to have obeyed the court order, now the chief arms officer's defense, if you will, is that, well, I don't believe the court order is valid. You can't do that. It's just over and over and over again, all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada, repeatedly, they say you can't do that in the same hearing. If it's been outstanding for a year and you chose not to oppose the court order, then you're in violation of not obeying the court order. It's the easiest example is if you have a traffic ticket and you don't pay it, then guess what? There's interest that accrues. Now, if you say, I don't believe in the validity of the traffic ticket, well, you should have opposed the traffic ticket. You don't leave something like that outstanding out there in the ether. You have to challenge it. Otherwise, the penalty starts accruing. In this case, if you don't challenge the court order, then your disobedience starts accruing. And it's a pretty hefty prison time, actually, goes along with it. I believe 2 years for that and 14 years for failing to produce property. So right now we're in the middle because the justice, the Superior Court justice said he believes that the written arguments deserve a written response from him. And I don't know if he's going to listen to Slamfire Radio, but I don't think anything I say now is going to change his mind. But we're going to hear back from him with a verdict soon. So and we'll see what comes of that.
So what is he going to rule on? That the CFO will be charged or that CFO needs to finally give you the ATT once and for all? Or both? What's his ruling going to be?
It's tricky because there were two sets of requests in front of him. One request in front of the Superior Court judge was, let's commit the CFO to trial for failure to obey the court order.
Yeah.
That's just the same thing I sought in front of the Justice of the Peace. And the second thing in front of the Superior Court justice was, now let's go ahead and cite not only the chief arms officer, but the chief arms officer's enabling government attorneys. Because I truly, and this is a personal belief, I don't think the chief arms officer would have gone this legal route, and it's a strategic disobedience. I don't think he would have gone this route if not for some kind of political and legal cover. And we have in Ontario a long-standing tradition of liberal attorney generals, starting with Michael Bryant saying, you know, we have to ban handguns, we have to declare war on handguns. One of the most troubling phrases, quotations in the media that Michael Bryant once said was, we have to look at the narrow constitutional abilities available to us to ban handguns. So he's already talking about legal warfare. He's not talking about passing law. He's talking about tweaking the law. We have Chris Bentley, who is the subsequent attorney general to Michael Bryant. He went in front of a law committee, a group of lawyers, and said, we have to ban handguns. We have Attorney General John Gerritsen, who went publicly on Canada's national broadcaster, CBC, and said, we have to have a national handgun ban. So they supply attorneys to protect the chief arms officer. And I told the judge, I said, you know, these people are the same people who have defended the chief arms officer in 2012. Now they're defending them in front of the Justice of the Peace, and now they're defending the chief arms officer in Superior Court. I said, there's a pattern here. And I know that because right now the chief arms officer's legal counsel is 100% consists of government lawyers. None of this is personally paid for by the chief arms officer. So there is political cover, I believe, being extended, and that's my personal belief.
I would tend to agree with you. Now, your background, Dan, you mentioned what you do for a living, and I didn't hear the word attorney or litigator. How have you come by all this legal knowledge?
Well, I like to read. I've always really liked to read, and I believe anytime someone becomes a firearms owner in Canada, they have to develop an acute awareness of what the laws are, because everyone becomes a little bit of a mini lawyer, especially when you see them talk on CGN. But what happens is you need to know the rules. You need to know which version of a black 5.56 millimeter rifle is considered like a handgun that you have to have a special permit to move around, and which version of a black 5.56mm rifle is considered just like any other hunting rifle that you can move anywhere without anything, just a single license, not even a handgun license. So everyone becomes a little bit of a lawyer. I happen to read a little bit, I guess, more than most.
Just a touch more than the average firearms owner, and we thank you for it. What about costs, Dan? You mentioned that, of course, the CFO has the taxpayers flipping the bill for all his dates in court. What about you? How are you funding all of this?
Well, we have a really, really great community, and people have been really, really generous in terms of sending funds my way. Buying a transcript, especially of a day-long proceeding, isn't cheap, per se. You know, these things can run into the thousands of dollars, and especially if you talk as much as I do. But, you know, people have been sending money via EMT, electronic money transfer, and I am so sincerely touched and so sincerely appreciative. I mean, this is money that they could be doing anything in the world with, and this is their hard-earned money, and they've been throwing some of it my way, and I'm really, really appreciative from the bottom of my heart. I'm really thankful.
Well, I did want to take a second to plug that. I followed the CGN thread only briefly. I'm not very big into CGN. As most of our listeners know, I don't spend a lot of time there. But anyone who would like to help with Dan's legal costs could send an EMT to wallsstuff5@gmail.com. That's wallsstuff5@gmail.com. Anything you can send, $5, $500 would be great, but you know, anything you can send to help Dan fight this fight, and it's important to remember, you're thanking them, Dan, but the community needs to thank you, because as I said at the onset of this interview, we're all going to benefit from all the gains that you're making. So, you know, you're not just doing it for yourself, you're doing it for all of us, and on behalf of Flamefire Radio and our listeners, I, for one, would like to say thank you very much for all your efforts.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. And I mean, you know, we're all in this together, and like I said, it's just such a phenomenal community. You have people who you can really trust and get along with. Nicest people in the world I've ever met have been at a firing range, and I think that's almost a bit of a scare to certain social progressives, that when I'm in court, I'm surrounded by atheists, theists, Hindus, Jews, Muslims, people from all over the world, Russians, Germans, people from Spain. It's just so international, so diverse, any skin color, any gender, and that's a progressive kind of dream world. The only problem is we're all packing guns at a firing range, so no wonder people's heads implode. But yeah, we really have a great community in the Canadian firearms community.
Well, would you like to speculate at this time, Dan, as to how you think the judge is going to rule and what's going to happen next based on that ruling?
So, I mean, speculation is what speculation is.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know. Well, how about, all right, how about
no,
this?
No worries. If, I mean, I can speculate if you want.
Well, or let me ask a more direct question. If the judge doesn't rule in your favor, what's your next move?
That's a very, very good question. In order to appeal something, you have to have a basis for appeal. And the Superior Court, you might think that, you know, there's always Court of Appeal, Supreme Court. Superior Court has special powers to enforce court orders that may not necessarily exist. Those powers may not exist with a higher court. So in some ways, the Superior Court could be the last stop here. However, if there is an error in law by the Superior Court, there is a method of appeal upwards, I believe, from what I've studied. The other thing to know is, really, what is a judge saying here if and when he says that it's okay to disobey a court order if it comes from the Firearms Act? I would not personally want to be the one to tell firearms owners that there's a double standard in the law. And really, really quickly, I'll just sort of tell you, Canadian firearms owners, for the largest part, huge degree, will comply with the law no matter what it is. But there's something, a breakdown in trust. There's no law in Canada that says you must trust the law. And four words I never thought I'd ever hear myself say in my life. No warrant, no entry. Why would I ever say that to a police officer? I'd say, come in and have a cup of tea. You know, you feel you need to come into the house. Sure, I trust you. No, when there's a breakdown of trust and there's no obstruction charge by saying, officer, you know, show me a warrant or you ain't seeing the inside of my house. That's literally what happens. We'll comply with the law, but the trust in that law is eroding and eroding. And just very, very quickly, at the Senate hearings and at the parliamentary hearings about the long gun register, which, you know, Canadians thankfully scrapped, at some point there's a Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police, the CACP, and at one point they made this naked plea. They said, trust us when we say we need the long gun registry. And you know what? That trust simply wasn't there. The frontline officers, many people who put their careers and their promotions on the line, they stood with Canadian law-abiding firearms owners and they said, we don't trust the system. We know what goes on. So, you know, at the end of the day, we'll comply with the law, but the trust is eroding fast and furiously.
I think that's a great final thought, although perhaps not a very warm one, but I think it's a great final thought to end on. Matthew, anything to add?
That was fantastic, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us. I really hope that our listeners are able to step up and help you out a little bit with your legal costs. I wish you all the best in the upcoming verdict. And I hope that, you know, I'm standing right with you, hoping that it's a positive one. And should it be, I think it's going to be a good day for Canadians. And if it's not, then I guess we're there with you in the next step. And we'll continue to fight this thing because, hey, you're the guy that stepped up, and we all need to back you.
Thank you very kindly for having me.
Thank you, Dan. And we hope you'll come back and join us again after the decision.
Sounds like a plan.
Excellent. Thanks again, Dan.
You got it.
And we're back. So thanks again to Dan for joining us. It was, as usual, insightful, informative, and interesting. So I couldn't think of another adjective.
Guys like there. Dan remind me how not smart I is. You know, he's taking on the man all on his own with no official legal training. And I'm going to say it again. He's fighting for all of us. So please send him some cash.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah, were you going to say something?
I was not. No, I actually dropped the gun that I was cleaning and knocked my headset off my head, so that may have been a funky noise you heard.
While you pull yourself back together, I'm going to go
I'm back together now. I'm okay. So why don't you go ahead and read
us
this first
email. This first one comes to us from Dave. He says, hi, guys. Just listening to episode 28. See, he doesn't even wait till he's done before he critiques us. Just listening.
That's right.
And I'm already going to fling mud at you. He says, I can't believe you said nothing less than 12 gauge for crows. I've taken many with a 495 feet per second pellet gun at 20 yards. Good good hunting discussion, though. Keep it up. So he's whacking crows with a less than 500 feet per second pellet gun inside of 20 yards.
That's cool. I mean, you can do it if you get him in the head, I guess. Be a good shot.
Yeah, that is awesome. And, you know, that being said, I said nothing less than 12 gauge, but the last two crows that I've taken were with rimfire. There's that incredible.
Yeah, I've taken crows with rimfire as well, so I guess it just slipped my mind that I had done that.
No. And,
but now that being said, the traditional way of hunting crows is putting out a decoy, hiding in the woods, and calling them in and shooting them on the wing as they fly by, which is a 12 gauge job. If you manage to get them on the ground or you know in a tree with a good backstop,
yes, that's important.
Because you can shoot stuff. You can shoot stuff out of a tree with a good backstop. You know, you just have to make sure you know what's behind the tree. Sometimes there's a bigger tree with a big trunk that the bullet can go into. So, you know, if that's the case, yeah, you can shoot them out of a tree with a rimfire.
The two,
so, you know,
two that I got were out of trees. One with my 17 and one with my 5.97, actually. Which,
very nice.
that one had me a little nervous because he didn't die on the spot. He flew away and died somewhere else. I did recover him. But, the 17 was the best. I just watched him fall straight to the ground, and that's the way I like it. But, yeah. So, hey, If you're whacking crows from your kitchen window off your garbage bag on a Wednesday morning before the truck gets there with a pellet gun, then good on you.
Cool. Yeah, as long as your discharge laws let you do that in your municipality. Or if they don't, you're using a really quiet pellet
gun. That was not legal advice.
Absolutely not. We leave that for Dan, and even he doesn't.
How about you take this next one from Mike?
From Mike. So I've been following CRR for the last 2 years, but I had to go on a hiatus late last year as I moved from military to civilian policing and was away on course. During the first few months of listening, I went back and started from episode one. First off, that was painful. Hey, I'm happy to report that neither Trevor or I was on episode one of CRR, so don't worry about insulting us. Secondly, it's true what they say about things getting better as they age. I wrote in a few times and also became a fan of the Gun Dudes, for better or worse, through you guys. Coming back after training, I decided that I would kill the Southern Ontario commute to and from work by listening to an episode a day and get caught back up. But you guys were nowhere to be found, and by you guys, I believe he's referring to CRR. Not sure what happened, but it wasn't the same. Was working a construction site today for 12 hours and ended up streaming your new podcast in, again, starting at episode 1. 11 episodes later, I have to say that I love the new format, and Slamfire's replaced CRR as one of the few podcasts I'll tune in for. Well, that's high praise. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. I'm sorry that you're losing IQ as you listen, but, you know, it is what it is. We all, you know, we all can't be lawyers.
Dan.
Question for you guys, though. Are any of you heading down for SHOT Show this year? I'm heading down there regardless through some connections I have, but wouldn't mind getting a media pass to take some pictures. Any experience applying for this? And would you be interested in sponsoring the media portion of my pass for an exclusive on a write-up and any pics? We're not going, I don't believe.
No.
I'll have to talk it over with Trevor and Owen, but I don't have a problem with doing something like that and having you go down there and
I don't know
and,
this guy.
Take some pictures
for us. I don't know this guy. What if he goes out and makes us look bad? Oh, wait. How could he possibly?
I don't think he possibly could make us look worse than we are. So, that you know what?
I don't think that a Canadian podcast is ever going to get a media pass for SHOT Show. But anyway, that being said, to answer your question, none of us have applied for one. None of us have any experience in applying for one or get. We wouldn't even know how to tell you how to start or where to start.
That's now, right. Yeah, if you know what you're doing and all you need is some media to say, yes, you're going on behalf of us, I don't think that that's an issue. So we'll send you another email and firm stuff up. But that's cool. I hope you have fun down there. I'd really like to go. I just can't swing it. I got too many other things going on.
Yeah, me too. The too many other things I have are called debts.
those are important to take care of from time to time.
Especially when you're, you know, buying new guns. So,
yep.
Cool. This next one is from Rossinator, and he says, to the Slamfire Radio Smack, to survive the zombie apocalypse, overall, if I could have what was best and ammo was available, PS90 and FN57.
Fantastic choices. Oh, I can't believe I forgot about those. They're fantastic. The pistol holds like 30 rounds.
Can believe you forgot about them.
Oh, I see. I thought you were saying that you can believe. Yeah, never mind. So
No.
Anyway, yeah, no, good choices. I like it.
He goes on to say common ammo between both units, low recoil and weight, so you can carry lots and not get worn down by taking down swarms of zombies, and it is effective out to 300 meters. If the ammo was more common, this would be the best choice.
And that's the problem with that caliber. It's so hard
to
find.
It's what, again, it's a neck down something. Carl had one. Yeah, Carl had one. It's a 9x25 or something. Yeah.
It's 5.7 by something.
I have
other.
No idea. Yeah.
It's a small neck down rifle cartridge. It's just so hard to find. I mean, if it was plentiful like 5.56 or 22 or, you know, then great.
It's definitely an effective round to get the job done, no question.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So he goes on again to say, that said, if ammo supply was a concern, Chris Vector and HK-45, both in 45 ACP, will go down when it will go down when you hit it. Ammo everywhere, and it is effective against other humans who might convert what you have. 22
who might covet
what you have. 22. I put this email in and didn't change the spacing, and it's all
at all. Yeah. It's a little messed up. That's okay. No,
so he
great.
Says, "Thank you. That wasn't condescending at all." 22 has its merits, but in that you were assuming all foes are zombies and not folks of nefarious character.
Well, not really. I think the 22.
I don't want to get shot by one.
No, I don't want to get shot by one either. But that being said, you're probably right. The 45 would be a better choice there. Again, though, can you find 45 as easily as you can find 22? I know I can't. I know I've got lots and lots of 22, but I don't have very much 40. Well, I don't have any 45, but let's say 9mm. Even 9mm is hard to find in quantities that you can find 22 in. But you're right, though. It is definitely more common than that 5.7 by whatever the crap it is. So that's very true.
And then
I do want to interrupt here again, though. Trevor, you almost had a similar setup. You had the Sub 2000 and the Glock 17, and both took 9mm, both took the same magazine.
I had the 33. I had three 33-round mags. I can't, you know, I was just...
That was a great setup for zombies. I mean, it's not a great setup for anything else, really.
True.
I mean, you can't shoot three-gun with it, really.
But with a red dot,
you can't.
You're going to hit man-sized targets out to 100 all day with a Sub 2000.
Oh, easy. Yeah. Man, I can hit man-sized targets with my open sights and my 22 out to 300 yards. Got videos to prove it. So,
then he talks about one of my favorite guns of his that I fired, the Bon Armed. I don't like the name. I'm not a big fan of the name, but it's...
What, the Lizard Slayer?
The Bon Arms Snake Slayer with 410 buckshot for a last-ditch backup piece would be in there, too. Nothing says out of my face like 410 buckshot in the nose. Well, maybe the crotch, but that won't go. But that won't do much against a zombie. So head it is.
I'd love to shoot one of those. I haven't played with one of those yet, but it looks like a
it's
neat
got a
little
great
gun.
Trigger, and by great I mean horrific. For my wife, Daniel Defense MK18 ACOG, nice and short, with her HKP30, lets her deal at range when I'm in close. My two-year-old gets a super soaker loaded with holy water. Have you considered making bouncing Bettys for an ensconced position? No, I have not considered making a bouncing Betty. I don't even know what that is.
It's a landmine that when you step on it, it bounces up to about head height and takes off your head.
Actually, now there's food for thought.
It's actually about chest height, but I'm just assuming the zombies have worn down to their knees.
Next point he wants to correct us on. Benelli versus Remington Versamax. Benelli any day. We don't all have your money, Ross. I own shotguns of both brands, and Benelli any day, all day. If the CSSA and the NFA need to raise money, what about having a CFO dunk tank at their AGMs? $20 a ticket would be a moneymaker, in my opinion, and I have to agree with them.
I can't imagine either any of them signing
up. Imagine
a
CFO actually doing that. No. Keep up the good work and have fun, Rossinator. P.S. Why would you want to be Ron Burgundy? He has no guns. Try I am Bert Gummer. I am Animal Mother, and you're not.
I don't
obscure
get
references
it.
There, Ross, that are lost on me, I'm afraid, but I'm just not as cultured as you are. That's clearly evident. So I am Animal Mother, and you're not. Okay. And who's this Bert Gummer guy? I don't know.
I'll Google
that later when I'm not Googling it.
All right. Well, up next we have a couple of submissions from the Mr. Peter Dawson himself. So let's play those, and we'll be back in just a sec.
Hello, Matthew, Trevor, and Owen, and all the listeners of Slamfire Radio. 10X here, once again calling Civilization on the 10X Basement Broadcasting System. I must apologize for having been absent for some time, but I feel some of the responsibility must fall on that fellow from Nickelback, who was meant to wake me at the end of September. Some fault may also lie with the fact that, like Rob Ford, I also have a smoke crack. It was after an unfortunate attempt to light my farts, and there was some blowback. The smell of burnt hair still lingers in my nostrils. Rest assured, I have been listening to the episodes, even if I haven't been gracing the airwaves with comments regarding them. However, the last episode and the mention of a cage fight between the beards of the presenters has prompted me to send in this comment. I would like to advance myself as a contender for the match, as I am currently sporting a rather dapper goatee as part of my efforts for Movember. Dynex is asked to be considered also, as he has a wicked peach fuzz on his top lip, but his expertise in Taekwondo may give him too much of an edge. Well, I have wasted enough of your listeners' time already, so it's time to bow out. I will leave you with an additional file that you may want to play at an appropriate time. Till next time, wherever you go, there you are.
Oh, very nice. Thank you, Peter, for sending that in. And yeah, the other file we will play at a more appropriate time.
Indeed. I don't think there is an appropriate time for anything that's related hey. To the doctor.
I'm just saying. Well.
Now, shall we move into
Best so iTunes review this week? Bring it into Soto's, because we haven't had
All right. Excellent. Yeah. I got a couple. One goes to listener, I believe it was Ross B., who suggested that we interview Dan Bilowski this week after we had already decided to do it. So a dollar short and a day late. So thanks for nothing.
Awesome.
No, thank you very much. It's great that the listeners want to hear us do those kinds of things. So we were more than happy to have Dan on, and actually we're quite grateful that Dan would lower himself to come hang out with us. So frankly, I'm surprised he agreed to the
interview. He was actually very flattered and humbled, he said, at the fact that we have listeners asking for him. He was quite taken aback at that. So so thank you very much for making his day, I guess.
Yeah, if you really want to
Send him money.
Don't just ask for him. Send him money, yep. this next one goes to, I'm going to try and pronounce it correctly, but, you know, I can barely pronounce the word correctly, to Mr. Kraus?
I believe it's Smith.
Krusty? What do you... yes, K-R-U-S-E is definitely pronounced Smith. Yes, so Mr. Kraus, for the tutorial on how to pronounce
really
by cool, I'm pretty sure we Beckle. Had it the first time.
it's by Beckle.
Whatever. I listened to two videos.
They both
and
said
both
Beckle.
Videos
You're
had
right.
different pronunciations.
Bacal.
They both yes. Lake Bacal is the world's deepest
20%.
Lake and holds what was it? 20%, yeah, of
That's
the
right.
world's
the
fresh
of it here in Canada.
Water. So there you go. We actually did watch your video. Good video, by the way. Lots of eye candy.
Very good.
Yeah. So next, Owen. I don't know if I ever thanked Owen properly. I think I did. I offered to pay him, and he said, I'll let you know, which means he's not going to let me know. But during the three-gun shoot, with everything else we had going on, Owen installed the sink for me.
And I'm chopped liver, I guess.
That's just how awesome he is.
I certainly did at least 20% of my work. You can ask Owen on that.
I don't. I won't, because I don't want to have him lie on your behalf.
Hey,
he's the plumber.
I'm also a plumber because I fixed a thing at work there the other day.
What, did you stay at a Super 8 hotel or something? Now you think you're a plumber? Anyway, Owen.
Thanks for the tank.
Yes, and I'm sorry that Matthew tried to steal some of your credit. And to Thomas Donnelly, thank you for putting a front sight for my Tanfoglio Stock 3
and
in
Thomas,
the mail for me.
From me,
that's awesome.
Stop just, encouraging him. You're sending him parts for a 1911. Come on.
Huh?
Oh, that's just as bad.
No, for my Tanfoglio.
Yes,
and
do.
I don't own a 1911. But you know what Thomas actually did? He actually, whether he emailed them, I think he emailed them, he actually has a quote from one of the
saying that it's
employees
clearly a 1911.
Of STI explaining that the 2011 is in fact a 1911. Still not good.
They don't know what they're talking about.
That's right. They shouldn't have stuck 2011 on the side. Matt, a.k.a. Onagoth from CGN, thank you for the great handguard that's in the mail for my STI build, even though I already bought a brand new one from Brownells. Nah, whatever.
Hey,
two
is
two
one
now.
And
it's
one is
good.
None, so you can install
and to all
them
the
both.
Listeners,
wouldn't that be wicked cool?
There you go. I could, actually. I could couple them together. Double-barreled
nice.
Air. I'm on to something. Not even Red Jacket thought of that.
We're
going to
change everything.
Never mind.
This is a game changer.
Yes. It's never been done before. To all the listeners who sent me birthday wishes that are friends of mine on Facebook, thank you so much. It was really cool to see all you guys sending me a little B-Day wishes, so thank you very much. That's it for me. Matthew,
no.
Got any shout-outs?
That's it. That's all. Sorry. I don't like anybody.
Well,
no, I'm kidding. You know, shout-out to Andre if he in
That's
fact
fine.
He does listen. Thanks for taking me hunting there the other day. It was a lot of fun. And, I guess that's pretty much it.
Cool. Well, guys, be sure to join one or both of our National Firearms Association, either the Canadian Shooting Sports Association or the National Firearms Association. They're working for us to try and get back some of our freedoms and make sure that we hold on to the few that we have. Also, be sure to check us out on the Gun Owners of Canada website. It's an awesome place to go hang out and talk guns with a bunch of other internet-type folks. And please, like us on Facebook, the local library, well, Matthew's local library currently has 266, but dude, we are closing the gap. We made it up to 244 as of today.
We're getting there,
so
though.
So we're
we
a
are
few
closing
likes
the gap.
Away.
Trevor is right on that count.
Be sure to check out all the other great shows on both the Canadian Reload Radio Network and the Crusader Podcast Network. There's tons of great material on each. And, that's it for now, folks. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely.
And,
stay safe out there, guys. We'll
be sure
see you
to
next
take somebody
week.
Shooting.
I am Ron Burgundy.
It's time to get a gun. That's what I've been thinking. Well, I gotta get a gun.
So if you have any comments or questions for the show, please send an email to slamfireradio@gmail.com. Now go grab a gun and shoot something.
When the talking is over, it's time to get a gun.